If you've been listening to the news at all over the past few weeks, it's likely that you've heard the term fiscal cliff hundreds of times. And although it's clearly something bad, many of us would be hard-pressed to explain what the term really means. So we thought that we would tackle the fiscal cliff on today's Please Explain to learn how it is that we have come to the edge of it and what our lawmakers are proposing to prevent us from falling off of it. Joining us are David Wessel, economics editor for The Wall Street Journal and the author most recently of Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget, and Mattia Kramer, a senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project. She is the lead author of the National Priorities Project's new book called A People's Guide to the Federal Budget. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Thanks for having me.
David, I've also heard it referred to as a fiscal reckoning, but in either case, it sounds quite ominous. If it's so serious, why did it go largely unmentioned during the election campaign, not just by the two presidential candidates, but pretty much anyone running for the House or the Senate?
Well, you know, some people call it the fiscal slope or the fiscal curb because they don't think it's quite as big a deal as the words fiscal cliff say. I think it was mentioned some during the campaign, but we're not very good at looking forward to things that happen in the distant future. And when you're running for president in August, September, and October, you're focused on Election Day. And it seemed like something that was irrelevant to the campaign because it was technical. So President Obama and Governor Romney did talk about the deficit. And they did talk about taxes, for sure, and they did talk about Medicare. But they didn't, you're right, focus on this particular end-of-the-year reckoning, this deadline that Congress and Mr. Obama set for themselves last year.
And, Mattia, I've also heard it described as a wicked problem, which I gather is a way of saying it's a huge problem with no clear solution. You've called it more of an obstacle course than a cliff. Can you explain the difference?
Yeah, so fiscal cliff makes us think that this is something monolithic. We either go off a cliff or we don't. But obstacle course brings to light the fact that this cliff is actually a whole bunch of distinct changes in tax and spending policy. And they all happen to be scheduled for the start of 2013, but lawmakers have options to go ahead with some of these policies and avoid others. And so I've used the term obstacle course. I think that was originally coined by the Economic Policy Institute because it may be a better metaphor.
So whether we go over the cliff or zigzag through the obstacle course, what are we really talking about here?
Well, we're talking about huge spending cuts that are scheduled to take effect automatically across the board to affect nearly every program in the discretionary budget at the start of 2013. And then some big tax increases, too. In particular, the Bush-era tax cuts are the tax change most talked about, but there are some others that are also included in this and rolled up in this big fiscal cliff. And if we did go ahead with all of the policies that make up the fiscal cliff or the fiscal obstacle course, it would likely be very difficult for our economy. We'd likely go back into recession in 2013. But I put forward the idea that it's unlikely that lawmakers will actually go ahead with all of these policies. We're likely to avoid some of the big ones, perhaps the biggest ones, and then that will very much soften the blow, so we won't be looking at disaster at the start of 2013.
Well, David, why was it created to have such a draconian result?
It was created because Congress and the President wanted to force themselves to do something different. In August 2011, there was a showdown between President Obama and the Republicans in Congress about lifting something that's called the federal debt ceiling, a kind of archaic law that says that Congress has to approve the amount of debt that the Treasury issues, and they only approve it a little bit or a lot at a time. If they hadn't approved it, it could have had all sorts of bad consequences for the credit of the United States, for the financial markets. No one really knows because we never tried it. So in order to get the votes to do that, they had to promise to do something on the deficit. They came up with about $1 trillion of spending cuts over 10 years. Then they created this special committee of 12 members of Congress. It's been called the Super Committee, and said, you guys find some way to save another trillion or so out of the federal deficit. And in order to force the Super Committee to come to a compromise, if they said, and if you don't do it, after the election in December 2012, We'll cut spending across the board indiscriminately, the kind of meat axe approach to cutting spending, on the same day that all these tax cuts expire. It was meant to prevent them from doing something. It was meant to force their hand.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of weird to imagine people doing things like this. It's almost like a suicide pact. The problem is that the election kind of put everything on hold, and now there's going to be a rush to see if they can find some way to do something differently.
Well, Mattia, the debt ceiling has been raised over the years by both when there were both Democrats and Republicans in the White House. Why was it a problem this time? Is this because of the Tea Party?
In large parts of the 2010 elections did put into office many representatives of the Tea Party who said that they wouldn't go ahead with raising the debt ceiling, that they were going to put their feet down. But David makes the important point that in many ways this is an archaic policy, this notion of a debt ceiling. And so the idea that that was where they drew the line in the sand was problematic for a number of reasons. Going over and failing to raise the debt ceiling at that point would have likely raised interest rates. So we would have had a government shutdown, a default on government debt, and likely raised interest rates for everyone. So it would have just been hugely catastrophic.
Tied to this all is the expiration of the Bush tax cuts.
That's right. So this is actually perhaps the most contentious point of the fiscal cliff. So whereas we have these automatic spending cuts that are in the queue, both Democrats and Republicans want to avoid sequestration. As David said, it's a suicide pact. Nobody wants to go ahead with it, often for different reasons. Whereas the Bush-era tax cuts, there's a lot of disagreement. Perhaps the greatest point of disagreement in all the negotiation over the fiscal cliff is what to do about the Bush-era tax cuts, and in particular, the tax cuts that benefit the highest-earning Americans.
My guests are Mattia Kramer, Senior Research Analyst at the National Priorities Project, David Wessel, Economics Editor for The Wall Street Journal. We are talking about the so-called fiscal cliff, a term that actually was coined by Ben Bernanke, I guess, as a warning for what we are now facing. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We invite your questions at 212-433-9692. If you're as confused about this as pretty much everybody else I've spoken to, I'm sure you have a couple of questions. You can also leave a comment or a question on our show page at WNYC.org. Let's get back to that word sequestration. David, that means an across-the-board spending cut, shaving roughly 9% from discretionary spending in the federal budget. Just across the board, everything gets cut 9%?
Not quite. So sequestration, like appropriation, discretionary, authorization, entitlement, mandatory, these are all words that are used by insiders in Washington that have great meaning to the people who do budgets and, in my view, completely exclude the public from what is a very important question of public policy. How much money should we spend on what, whom should we tax, and how much? Sequestration is a term that came into favor, about 25, 30 years ago. And what it says is that if we don't meet some target, a deficit target of some kind, then there are spending cuts. And they're very intricate rules, but it does take across-the-board spending in defense and domestic programs for those things that Congress appropriates annually and a little bit out of Medicare. It doesn't hit the whole federal budget, but the most important thing is it's nobody's sense of priorities. It's indiscriminate. It goes across the board. But as Mattia says, it's not like they turn the spigot off and all the offices of the federal government closes. It's spread out over a period of time, and the White House Budget Office has quite a bit of flexibility for a few weeks anyways if they're still working on a deal. So the lights will not go out in your Social Security office or in your congressman's office on January 2nd, even if they hit even if they go over the fiscal cliff.
But, Mattia, as I understand it, the Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program is expiring, and this would save $26 billion, also end payments to millions of unemployed people, and Medicare payments to doctors would be reduced by 27%, or $11 billion. That would probably leave an awful lot of people searching for doctors who are willing to take these reduced Medicare payments.
So these are some of the smaller policies that are rolled up in the fiscal cliff. They're getting much less coverage, but they're important in their respective ways. So the expiration of emergency unemployment benefits, that's certainly not a catastrophe for the economy writ large, but it will be devastating for a small group of the most vulnerable Americans. And hardly anybody's talking about extending those unemployment benefits. Nonetheless, that is part of the fiscal cliff. And in fact, that's a part that's likely that we go ahead over, or an obstacle that we run right into. However, with the reduction in payments to doctors that's scheduled for the end of the year, this is something that Congress has come up against many times. It actually dates back to legislation originally passed in 1997. The likelihood is that lawmakers will, at the last minute, avoid that and come up with a doc fix, as it's been called, in order to maintain payment rates for doctors providing services to Medicare patients.
But if we go over the cliff, would taxes and spending cuts go into effect immediately? Or is this more, as you suggested earlier, a fiscal slope?
The slope is probably a better way of looking at it. So David's just said, the lights won't go out immediately in your Social Security office, certainly not. Those cuts would be spread out over the course of the year. That would give lawmakers many opportunities to reverse them if they didn't stop them before January 2nd. They would also, tax cuts would be spread out over the year. It would increase withholdings, paycheck withholdings at the start of the year, but that too wouldn't be immediately devastating. So lawmakers have the opportunity to amend the fiscal cliff should we go off it. But it's also important to note that, it wouldn't be the greatest thing from the perspective of the U.S. economy and financial markets and so forth to go over the cliff and then deal with it retroactively. It would be nice to think that we can rely on our elected officials to go about a much more responsible means of budgeting for this country.
Hasn't this approach, Congress self-imposing a future crisis, helped solve past budget disputes? In fact, ever since the Reagan administration? David?
No, that's not. I don't think so. I think that there were a number of things like this. There was this Graham, Rudman, Hollings thing, but actually they mostly failed. And what mostly happens is sooner or later the President and Congress of whatever party decide to do something about the deficit. And then, having come to some consensus about what to do, which is actually what they're trying to do right now. There seemed to be a very positive meeting between the congressional leadership and the president just today in Washington at the White House. After they come to an agreement, then these rules do a good job of helping them stick to their promises. So one of the more successful budget deals was implemented in the early 1990s when the first George Bush was president. The Democrats controlled the Congress, and they cut a deal, and they raised taxes and cut spending, and then they made certain procedural rules. They put caps on annually appropriated spending. They said if we're going to cut taxes or increase benefits, we're going to find offsetting revenues or savings to pay for them. And those things relatively well held. And the reason they held is because they were implementing a consensus. Usually when Congress points a gun at its head, it pulls the bullets out at the last minute rather than pulling the trigger.
But different people have staked out positions and said that they will not be moved. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll talk about those and take some listener calls. Our number here, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. My guests are on today's Please Explain look at the so-called fiscal cliff. We've already given about six or seven other names. Are David Wessel, economics editor for The Wall Street Journal. His book, Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. Mattia Kramer is a senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project. She's the lead author of a book called A People's Guide to the Federal Budget. Again, the number 212-433-9692. If you are curious about the fiscal cliff, you can leave a message on our show page at WNYC.org. We are back with today's Please Explain segment with Mattia Kramer, a senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project, and David Wessel, economics editor for The Wall Street Journal. We're talking about the financial cliff and how it's going to be avoided, and we're assuming it will be avoided. But I've been reading the papers and seeing how people have been staking out their positions. President Obama says he wants to extend tax cuts for all Americans except the wealthiest, and then eliminate some tax loopholes for the wealthiest. House Speaker John Boehner has called for raising taxes, has called raising taxes unacceptable, and said that the new revenue should be generated by economic growth from a simpler tax code that eliminates some loopholes on deductions. And then we have the Simpson-Bowles Commission recommendations, which everybody seems to be ignoring, and that is to extend or further lower tax rates and eliminate most tax breaks. Do you think that there is much give there?
Well, I'm not sure I would characterize it the way you did. First of all, I would say don't assume that we're going to escape the cliff. I think that there's some small chance that they'll be unable to agree that we'll go over the cliff. If we do that, I don't think we'll stay over the cliff very long. I suspect that the markets would be pretty upset and that would get the members of Congress off their rear ends and do something. But I don't think you can promise people that we're going to avoid this. Secondly, on the other hand, I think things are a little more fluid and congenial right now than your description suggests. President Obama says he wants to raise tax rates on upper-income Americans. Republicans do not want to raise tax rates on upper-income Americans, but they've pretty much thrown in the towel on getting more money from those people beyond what you'd get for more economic growth. Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader at the White House today, said if the president's willing to take some cuts in benefits, we're willing to put revenues on the table. So at this stage, I think the rhetoric is kind of we can work this out. And maybe there's some way for us to find a deal here without either of us completely surrendering our principles. Now, I'm not suggesting they're going to succeed or that they even mean everything they're saying, but right now, each side seems to think it's in their interest to at least appear to begin bargaining.
But Mitch McConnell is the minority leader in the Senate.
Right.
Isn't the more important figure here John Boehner and some of the people that he's had certain tensions with in his group in the House?
Well, John Boehner was also at the White House today, and he's kind of singing a little bit of Kumbaya right now, too.
So,
but, you know, the trouble is, if you look at their statements and you read them as if you are Anton Scalia reading the Constitution, you can come up with almost any conclusion. These things are so carefully worded, and they're not showing you what their real bargaining position is. Secondly, don't make no mistake. Mitch McConnell is important. There's a lot of sentiment in the Senate from the few moderate Democrats and Republicans in the Senate who are left, who kind of want to do a deal on the deficit, who think we got to get it beyond this. And if they can get enough votes in the Senate, and if Mitch McConnell says, you know what, I can live with this, and Barack Obama says, you know what, I can live with this too, the pressure on the Republicans on the House to go along will be very strong. John Boehner appears to want to cut a deal. He has to worry about his right flank, people who will vote against it and who may try and unseat him. So what Mitch McConnell does makes a big difference in what the atmosphere is and how many Republicans in the House will actually join hands and with Democrats and do something.
Mattia, do you have anything you want to add to that?
I think that there's a lot to work with. They're putting on the table closing tax loopholes. Republicans have put forth some willingness. Yes, it's a bit difficult to read, as David's pointing out. The fact that they're putting that on the table creates a possibility that something really could happen. So I like that way of looking at it, that there is hope of coming to some sort of agreement on taxes that creates a revenue positive deal.
Let's take some calls. Cy from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. My question is, this whole problem could have been avoided if they follow the recommendation of Senator Harkin when he addressed the Senate chamber, and he cited the Constitution of the United States, I believe the 14th Amendment, that the United States debt shall not be questioned. Now, at that time, that was a great opening for the president to stand up versus the Tea Party. I'd like your comments on that United States Constitution, 14th Amendment.
Well, I'm not a constitutional lawyer. It happens that the president of the United States is, and he says that 14th Amendment thing wasn't sufficient to give him the power to continue to issue debt of the U.S. Treasury without congressional consent.
Okay. Thank you for your call. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Kevin from Brooklyn.
Yes, how are you? In effort to get Congress to negotiate in good faith, meaning not just stand on principle, but really sit down and try to crunch the numbers and make something happen, I suggest we present the doubling in size of each congressional district, thereby putting the job of half of our Congress people online unless they make something happen. Now, this can be presented in a convincing way by suggesting this is our first item on the table in effort to cut the budget.
It sounds like a proposal that I would have read about in The Onion, but it would be effective, wouldn't it?
Well, it would require a constitutional amendment that the members of Congress would have to vote for.
Now, let's look at Medicare, which has been particularly problematic in all of this discussion. The president would reduce payments to Medicare providers and increase premiums for some retirees. House Speaker John Boehner says he would raise Medicare eligibility to age 67. Would that and then, of course, House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, at least up through now, has talking about creating a voucher program that was kind of squelched during the campaign, but it isn't dead. Are these also all negotiable things?
A problem with the way that healthcare has been talked about, in particular during the election, but in other conversations too, is that we haven't put forth ways of actually controlling healthcare costs. What we've talked about mostly is shifting costs from the federal government to other groups of people. And healthcare costs are a major driver of growing federal spending. And in order to talk about long-term deficits, we've got to talk about healthcare costs. And so actually controlling costs as opposed to moving, shifting costs from one group to another is a discussion we've got to have. You know, there are brilliant healthcare economists out there who talk about the power of moving away from a fee-for-service system, for example, to something called pay-for-performance. So we've got to look at proposals that seriously think about how to reduce healthcare costs as opposed to just shift costs from someone to someone else.
Well, how does that work in relation to Obamacare?
Obamacare actually puts forth pilots in the Medicare program to look at how accountable care organizations, as they're called, could help to drive down healthcare costs. So he does put forth an important policy in that regard. But some healthcare economists say we've got to move much quicker in that direction. We've got to make much bigger steps toward that in order to seriously get down and hold down healthcare cost growth.
Social Security is also something that's been brought up as something that might be changed, although Harry Reid says he will not discuss changes to Social Security under any circumstances. Simpson Bowles, that commission recommended raising the eligibility to 69.
Over,
do you think Americans would go by that?
And what year was that going to happen by?
Oh, it would be we're kicking it down the road.
2050.
Yeah.
So look. Medicare is just as she described it. It's very complicated because it's not just Medicare for the elderly. It's Medicaid for the poor, and it's all the private health care system we have. And you've got to be careful you don't do things to one part of the system, like raise the eligibility rate for Medicare, that does something bad to another part of the system, which would then force all those people to buy health insurance in the private market. So it's complicated. Social Security is conceptually easy and politically tough. We know what has to be done. There's some combination of higher taxes on Social Security, on wages for Social Security, changing the benefit formula, and tinkering with the retirement age. And you can argue about what's the best way to do it. I think what Simpson Bowles said is, look, here's one way to do it, but for gosh sakes, let's get on with it so we can make the program sustainable. My judgment is that this won't be part of the deficit talks, that they don't like to see, Republicans and Democrats, that is, don't like to be seen as cutting Social Security to reduce the deficit. And what they'd rather do is do Social Security separately and say, we are making Social Security solvent for the next 75 years, and just have it on a different page of the newspaper.
My guests are David Wessel, economics editor for The Wall Street Journal, author most recently of Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. Mattia Kramer, Senior Research Analyst at the National Priorities Project, lead author of a new book called A People's Guide to the Federal Budget. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. I'm going to read some of the things that people have written in. Just read them straight without making any comments of my own.
Can't you get to put them to music or something? Don't just read them straight. You know?
No, no, no. There's a temptation to comment, but I'm not going to do that. Suzanne from Connecticut is a fiscal conservative. It's troubling, she says, to hear that the debt ceiling is an archaic notion because paying debts is important.
Paying debts is important. And the problem we have is that Congress has adapted this practice where they spend money, they put it on the national credit card, and then they say, we have this parliamentary thing where we decide whether to pay the credit card. And in order to get leverage with the president, and this is a bipartisan operation, we'll withhold permission to pay the credit card in order to get him to do something else. The debt ceiling was invented. It was supposed to give the Treasury more flexibility. Before World War I, Congress had to approve each time the Treasury sold bonds. In order, that got too cumbersome, so instead they went to setting a ceiling. But now it's become a kind of lever on something that we have no choice but what to do. We borrowed the money. We have to pay the bills. We can't just decide from some parliamentary vote that we're not going to pay the bills because it plays well with the local press.
Rajiv from Bridgewater, New Jersey says, if the objective of the tax increases is to lower debt, then why is going over the cliff a bad idea?
So this is a really important point, right, because a lot of people think the fiscal cliff refers to too much debt or greater deficits, and in fact it's the opposite. If our number one priority was reducing deficits, then we would go straight for the fiscal cliff, and that would cut our deficit in half, roughly, in 2013 as compared to 2012. There's many, many other important issues at play, though, and a major one is our flagging economic recovery. So it's crucial that lawmakers balance long-term deficit reduction with policies that help the economy make its slow recovery in the near term.
And what would be the impact of raising taxes on everyone? It really would slow down the economy, wouldn't it?
Forecasters at Moody's have broken down the economic impact of the Bush-era tax cuts, letting them expire for folks in the lower 98% of the income bracket and then folks in the top 2%, since that's where how the political conversation breaks down. Moody's found that the economic impact of letting the tax cuts expire for everybody below the $250,000 income mark would be a substantial negative effect on the economy. They also found that allowing the tax cuts to expire for those over $250,000 in annual income would not be a catastrophic effect. So there is some play for lawmakers there to raise some new revenue while preserving our economic recovery.
On the other hand, many people in the Republican Party say that raising the taxes on the wealthiest would destroy job creation. Has the study looked into that?
Well, that's what the forecast predicts. So it does find that there would be some negative effects from allowing those upper income tax cuts to expire, but that the negative effects wouldn't be catastrophic. So that addresses that very question.
Well, can you explain this to me? We have these those tax cuts in effect right now. We're not seeing a lot of job creation. In fact, the unemployment rate has been holding pretty steady. So why do we even claim that they're effective?
Well, I think it's a really good question, and like all good questions, it has a more complicated answer than the nice, clear way you stated it. The first thing is, when you work in Washington or when you read the papers, you'd think that the only thing that mattered to economic growth is what the top marginal tax rate is. And in fact, it's really just one of many factors that determines how many jobs are created, how fast the economy goes. I mean, there are things like demographics, there's the quality of our education, there's what's going on in the rest of the world, whether you can borrow money to start a business and stuff like that. So the pace of the economy is not quite as sensitive to the top marginal tax rate as you think by reading the paper. The second thing is that these aren't ordinary times, right? We are suffering an economy that is far short of its full potential. We have nearly 8% unemployment, and that's just counting the people who say they're looking for work. So at a time like this, the economic textbooks tell us, you don't want to be raising taxes and cutting spending, certainly not too much, because if you do, you'll just make the economy worse. And if you want a case study, look at what's gone in Europe. They're doing the austerity budget in an IMAX style, and there's 25% unemployment in Spain. So what has to happen, and it's hard for people to understand this, is that nobody really is advocating taking a lot of federal money out of the economy on January 2nd, or even raising taxes on everybody on January 2nd. What they're saying is we should put in place a plan now so that when the economy's stronger, we've already passed the legislation so that we can bring down our deficits so they're not dangerous. Make the decisions now, have them take effect over a long period of time. That's what Simpson-Bowles said. That's what Domenici Rivlin said. That's what the president's budget proposes. And frankly, that's where they're going to end up.
We have very little time. Ken on the Upper West Side writes, what do your guests say to the contention that Republicans are manufacturing this deficit crisis to pressure Democrats to extend the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy and accept painful cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, something that Paul Krugman is suggesting? That he wrote, the looming prospect of spending cuts and tax increases isn't a fiscal crisis. It is instead a political crisis brought on by the GOP's attempt to take the economy hostage.
This gets back to the nuance between near-term economic recovery and long-term deficit reduction. So we do absolutely want deficits eventually to come more in line to a stable share of the U.S. economy. We don't want deficits to get ever larger as a share of our economy. So that is an important objective, but it's a long-term one. In the short term, our economic recovery ought to be a top priority. And so balancing those things, including in our political rhetoric, ought to be important.
You want to add to that, David?
No.
Okay.
It was a manufactured crisis. I think both sides had an incentive to manufacture it, and each side is trying to use it to its advantage. And like a strike deadline, management and labor are struggling to try and get a deal before the strike actually hits.
And E.J. from Westchester writes, the business world has been bracing for the fiscal cliff for almost a year. Is that your sense?
Yes. I think actually if they get a deal, I think people assume they're going to solve this problem. We're not going to go over the cliff, but they're not going to really get anything serious done on the deficit. I find growing number of people think we might go over the cliff, including in business. If they actually pull this off, if they get a deal
quickly
that promises deficit reduction, it'll make the economy and the markets very happy.
Thank you both so much for being on our Please Explain segment, David Wessel and Mattia Kramer. It's been great.